Before we get started, try these three tools. First, 99designs, the largest crowdsourced marketplace for graphic designs. When I used them, I wrote a description of the design I needed and how much I wanted to pay. I got a bunch of designs back, I picked the one I liked best and only paid for that, and that design was customized to my needs. Try them for logo design, blog design, app icons, and more. 99designs.com. Next sponsor is Grasshopper. Entrepreneurs like me love and use Grasshopper because it offers all the features of the big expensive phone systems, you know the kinds, multiple extensions, music on hold, call forwarding, and so much more. But Grasshopper works with any phone system and it's inexpensive. Grasshopper.com. Finally, PickClick. It's a one-person startup by my friend Ryan in San Diego. His site gives you a visual way to search eBay, Etsy, and other sites. It's already profitable and it's bootstrapped. You gotta check out PickClick, PICCLICK.com. And tell me what you think. PickClick.com. Here's your program. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. You guys know what we do here. Every day I bring on a different entrepreneur to talk about his or her experience. Today I've got Katrina Garnett. She launched Crossworld Software, which was sold to IBM. She's also the founder today of My Little Swans, a travel site for families that want to tour the world with their kids without compromise. I'm going to be asking her about Crossworld Software. I'm going to be asking her about what kind of travel she's done. I'm going to be asking her about My Little Swans, how she's launched and built that business. But let me hold off on that, because when we talked before the interview started, she said that she was willing to talk about women in technology, why there aren't enough. And I'm going to jump in on that opportunity because I want to do more interviews with female entrepreneurs here. I've been having a hard time finding them, and I get a lot of criticism for maybe discriminating against women or not being open-minded. I don't know. What do you feel about this issue?
Well, I personally, although I've never had discrimination, I think part of it is women go into the scenario with a bit of a sort of a guilt. They are a victimization mentality. I think you've got to go in a lot more optimistic, challenge your bosses. I always challenged my bosses at Oracle and Sybase. I always said, if I deliver, what do I get after that? I mean, they said I was probably horrible to manage because I always delivered, executed, results are all that matters. And then you just say, treat me the same as the man. If I'm going to be a VP, I want to prove I'm being, you know, total compensation, rewards, everything else is the same as a male. I just don't treat me any different. But that also means you have to deliver. So part of it is managing up to your management if you're inside a large company and planning your career. Don't take anything as an accident or don't wait for the handout. Go challenge your boss and say, well, what do I need to do next to move up the management? And when I finally left, I was at Oracle for 4 years, Sybase for 6 years. There were great environments. There were not many women at all, but there were great environments to learn. So you kind of figure out, well, what is it I want to do long term? The jobs I wanted to do long term were not there. That's why I eventually started Crossworlds, because I was bored. And it was because I'd already done as many things as I could inside those companies, and it was time to move on. And leaving something on a high note, so no one can say, you know, they're mostly in shock, why are you leaving? And there was this, a lot of celebrations from women because I was a woman that, quote, made VP at Sybase. And I'm like, guys, you know, you can do that too. So I do a lot of, well, I used to do a lot more of it, but speaking to Anderson consultants that were women, APs, a lot of them married to their clients, woke up at sort of 50 realizing they're still going on holidays with their mother. They have no life. They've missed out, not had kids, not gotten married. And they're pretty sad. You can't wind the clock back. So that's not saying that's bad, but it's like you can have it all. You should do both. Don't put your personal life or your career on hold. And partly I'm hoping I'm a good role model for that, because I believe I've truly done it all, had it all. I'm very happy and uncompromised, so then I don't have any regrets.
Why do you think there are more women in technology, more women CEOs, more women on the Forbes 400 list who've earned money through entrepreneurship?
Well, it's a great question. When I've lectured at the entrepreneur program at Stanford, it's mostly the women that come to this course and are asking really practical questions. And they're all entirely smart, but none of them have had the initiative to go take a class in the law school or gone and taken a class in the computer science department. A lot of them are not cross-pollinating. They might be great with numbers, but they, you know, and the last thing they want to hear is go carry a bag for, you know, go on the front lines and do sales for the first year of their careers. There's a little bit of, and I think the economy's changed a lot of that arrogance at this point. It's like, take whatever job you can get, but we always like to hire people who have tried other, a variety of things. Pretty much, if someone's smart, they can figure out how to do anything. And so when we start companies, you want that kind of personality, attitude, the DNA, the chemistry. And then because this company grows through thresholds from, getting to the first million is very hard, getting to the next 10 million is very hard, getting to the next 100 million, you have to have people who can scale their skills. They're not quitters. It's I hire by personality. So I don't actually care if it's a man or a woman, but we never found enough female resumes just coming to us. And so we thought, so it's not a discrimination. It's just there's not that many women out there. Although they say now 60% of the graduates coming out of academic schools are more women than men. So, but they didn't get specific about is it journalism? Is it communications? Is it marketing? They didn't get very specific about it.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Well, I'm opening it up to anyone in the audience who has any feedback on it. I want to be as open-minded as you guys think that I'm not. I'll accept all the feedback that you have. Let's move on with the interview and talk about you, Katrina. First of all, I'm fascinated that you think that you actually not just think, but you're showing that people can travel with their kids. I just got married. Olivia and I are talking about having kids. One of my big concerns is that I'm not going to be able to travel. We hopped here to Buenos Aires, got the flight, I think, a week or two before we flew down here. I don't imagine that I'll be able to do much of that when I have kids. You say there's a world of possibility. Let me ask you this. How old are your kids and what kind of traveling have you done?
Today they are, and this goes back to the fact that they've traveled for the last 15 years with me as I've worked full time as well. So a lot of it is how you can split your own brain of just believing that you can do all the sleeping in the world when you're dead. You don't necessarily have to sort of, it's how you manage your life, and either being optimistic or not. I truly believe there's a lot of places we cannot take our kids, 20 years down the road. The countries around the world are either just getting trampled with tourists. Or your kids just, they're not going to want to travel with you. I mean, once they're busy adults with their own lives, it gets even harder. So setting that sort of momentum and routine when they're younger, start as soon as you can. And most people just sort of say, I'm waiting, I'm waiting. They contrive reasons and excuses to not travel. Oh, he's going to walk and be all over the plane. We tell our kids, you just don't get up. It's like you get out of your plane seat, you lose your seat. Yeah, it's hard. We've got three kids today. They're 11, 12, and 16. They've all been traveling since they were one. And I think most of it is the creativity you put into planning the trips, making it age appropriate, but not compromising to your earlier point. Nobody wants a compromised trip. I mean, that's just not reasonable, but you do want to do careful planning. So a lot of our trips have had now a little more adventure-based trips. You talked about Buenos Aires. When we took them to Argentina, they did a lot of horse riding and fishing, glacier climbing. In Brazil, it was zip lining and rappelling. We'd never done those kinds of things before. So I think part of it is just having a really good sense of what you want to do. The kids really bond on these trips. They're offline for once, which is a huge important thing in this day and age, getting them off something like a Facebook for a while. I think the kids just, they build intimate relationships. They see cultures they'll never see in a classroom. There's so many reasons to travel with your kids. And then maybe they won't realize it for 5 or 10 years, but they do have these reflections.
To other people, I am getting a question from the audience here from Mark Ransom of AppRabbit. He's saying, do other passengers give you a hard time about your kids' behavior?
No, they're really good kids. Usually, I'm very tempted to give other parents with unruly kids. I don't say anything because parents get really temperamental on planes. We're very sensitive. Our kids understand that there's a protocol and a behavior that's expected, whether it's a 5-star restaurant or in a play or in a museum or on a plane. I mean, kids, partly too, I'll give this as an example. Depending on how you dress your kids also dictates a behavior. If you're going to put them in, quote, play clothes, at a fancy restaurant, they're going to think they can play. So if you make the effort to dress them up and say, well, three out of five dinners will be formal, make them dress up. But give them some ability to have some decision in what they're doing, where they're going. Balance out the itinerary so they have something they look forward to doing. So it's not just all about what the parents want to do. So on a plane, I think they know everyone else is staring at them.
So this is a passion of yours that you turned into a business back in 07. Do you ever feel like the business is encroaching on the passion that because you have to be aware of how you're having a good time on the trip so that you can take some of those tips back to the website, that it maybe just puts a damper on the trip a little bit? You ever feel anything like that?
I'm definitely the one behind the camera on all the trips because those photos are mine. But again, this personal angle, I drove a behavior with a lot of our friends that then they just kept asking for the trips. So I didn't mind sharing them. So it's become more of an efficient process to sort of have a content management site where we can put all the detail so that we're not having to redistribute sort of redundant questions about how to pack or just how long a drive was between point A and point B or just tips that we might take for granted because we're probably expert packers at this point. But that's how you take stress out of trips. It's you don't want to come back from somewhere too and have somebody else tell you what you missed or, God, I wish I'd known to do this. I would have done it different. It's like you spend a lot of money on these trips. So it's sort of travel wisdom where I think my kids understand the routine because they've been doing it for so long. I try not to let it dominate or get in the way, but we travel for our passions. Everybody, whether it be for art or food or the writing or some cultural language experience, everybody, as long as everybody's getting their thing, they seem pretty happy. And I don't think of it as work then. We do look forward to our holidays.
And you can make sure that all three kids get something that's their thing, and you're married, that your husband gets something that's his thing, and you have your own private time all on a short trip?
I'll give you an example.
Please.
On Saturday, we leave for Alaska, and it's because the kids love fishing. And this is serious fishing. I have to keep reminding you, it's one of our partners up in Canada, and I keep saying, we have children. Don't forget, these are not men. And they're like, and I love the approach when these lodges really want to share those kinds of experiences. It's like they're making sure these kids can still participate, even though it's a high-end lodge with real fishing. They loved it the last time they went to Alaska. They asked to go back. The next trip is in July, and they asked to go back to Greece to do a boat trip. That's one of their favorite trips. They know there's no sharks in the water. They love the food. My heritage is Greek, so I think they're throwing me a dog bone on that one, letting you know who doesn't want to go back. But part of it is my compromise is we have to fly through somewhere. You can't fly direct to Athens from San Francisco, so we'll go through Berlin. I said, guys, I have to go to some of the museums. We have not been back to those museums in 10 years. And so much has changed in Berlin. So they're willing to do that for 3 days. I said, but they know they're going to get their boat trip in Greece. Everybody gets what they want.
All right, we'll work our way backwards. I'll come back to Cross Worlds later on. Let's stick with my little swans. What is the business? You've mentioned that there are travel tips on there. I've seen a lot of great pictures. I've seen a membership portion of the site. What's the business, essentially?
Well, it's definitely, in a nutshell, cutting out the middleman. So most people are pretty comfortable on researching on the web for travel. I mean, there's almost too much information on the web. So part of it is looking at us as a filter to sort of say, I don't recommend something that was not good. It's just not there. So there's no kind of ratings. It's more about trying to emulate a lifestyle to say, well, if they're enjoying it and her kids are smiling, it's probably good. So people, that's why they identify with the photos. And if they want to see more photos, they then go to my MobileMe account and they get to see hundreds more photos. So then they know that's real. I've paid for all these trips myself, so it's like no one's paying me for this. So again, it's real experiences. Because I don't actually think a paid travel writer is having the same experience of dragging three children and doing the packing and unpacking. It's just not the same of one person being sent to a wonderful spa or a honeymoon place. It's just not the same. These kids just need, it's, if you can plan travel for kids at an uncompromised level, that's the hardest kind of travel to plan. That means everything else is easy. But you know, we do have a lot of couples trips on there that my husband and I have done together when the kids are either in school or just we wove it into a business trip or something. Like Bordeaux is on there. And because people ask me that all the time. Like when you take your kids to summer school, then what do you guys do? There's so much opportunity in the world. And so part of it's
we see the trips that you take and we see the possibilities, and then what else is there to do on the site? Do you book the travel for us?
Well, the question to the business model is I don't actually book anything. People, my goal, they just want to see the experience I've had. They want to see the pictures, then see the map so they can visualize from a geographical exactly where we went, and then they want the itinerary. They want to know exactly day by day by day all the detail. And it's pretty easy once we see the pictures, exactly me memorizing where we went to reconstruct the trip. And then the content management site lets us explore and add to those destinations quite easily. When I go back to a place, going back to Egypt or Jordan a second time or Greece a third time, you'll see those trips could show up multiple times and people can just sort of see all the trips.
And where's the revenue?
So the revenue becomes from the partner model. So once somebody has scanned one of my Africa trips, for instance, and they reviewed it all, or the regional best partners we have, that I've traveled with all of them, so they've all been vetted. I personally said I've used these people as the best on the ground for whether it be a region or a country. They then book the trip. So the site is fairly efficient when we convert, when somebody scans to the partner page. That moment, you know, the partner knows how to do best to sell the services of their business. They're the ones that are on the ground. There's no one else in the middle trying to interpret your needs. So once you start talking to that person right away, they're the best qualified person to say, well, what do you really want to accomplish on this trip? What did you really want to see? You know, what are the ages of your children? What kinds of passions do you have?
Do you charge the partner site advertising on the site, or do you get a commission off the sale?
It's basically a booking referral fee, and that's the expanded model for where our partners can include luxury products, because today we have my French jeweler, Lorenz Bommer, who now does high-end jewelry for LVMH, a watch guy that's in Geneva who just does the most amazing. So it's things people can't get here. So there's a huge open-ended opportunity for luxury products, services as well, where people still want somebody to handhold them. So the interesting thing here is travel agents really want to participate. And I basically sort of said, we can't get to you right now. We want to go direct to our travel operators, because most people, they're smart enough to figure out I don't need to pay that uplift of a middleman. I reverse engineered about 17 trips, and I realized how much we overpaid. And it was, I think a lot of people don't do that. They just keep booking future. They don't go back and look in the past what they did.
And then the travel partner keeps track of how many sales you've generated and sends back a commission based on that.
We have background processes that track the clicks when they hit the partner page, that then tracks a reconciliation report back to the partner. So it's all a background process in the site.
Okay.
There's also a community page where we do want to have user-generated feedback on trips as well. So if somebody, so the search facility is fairly powerful. So if somebody wants to say they're really into wine, maybe a community member can share much more about their wine experience trips. And it sort of then just organically grows. So it's not just my content or the partner's content, it's also the user-generated community content and how they can post their past trips and everyone can share it. It's a very Facebook-like community.
So I read in your bio that you invested $2.5 million of your own money into this business. Where does the money go in the business?
It took us a year to basically build what we had today. We had a full year of closed membership to get feedback last year. So the year before, we had to build it and write all the content. So basically, it's a very large, complex site. So I think we're probably, I know, $300,000 into development at this point. It required sort of a back end and a front end, which made it a lot to build. We also wanted to make sure it supported every browser, every device. So it was written to support the iPad when it was launched on April. So obviously that to me was a very smooth transition. It's a great way people can take their travel content with them when they go. So you can publish to yourself into the iPhone and the iPad. And that was a lot.
Wouldn't even a content management program like WordPress with a couple of plugins, including a membership plugin, allow you to have cross-browser compatibility, the ability to launch on iPad day one and iPhone on day one, and the ability to have a closed community?
Well, I think partly is we always wanted to not have to rewrite things that exist. So Social Engine is what we used, but for the social community. And it's a large PHP site that was in terms of what we used to write the rest of the community. The search facility was critical. The CMS had to be extensible for freshness and in terms of just the template structure and how the menus were going to basically scale out as we add content. The good news is it works the way it was designed because we've got a lot of content, a lot of photos. So it was designed for large image handling, video. I think for the high quality experience that you get in the site, then people don't get lost in terms of how the navigation works. Maps was a pretty big deal, not linking just to all the Google Maps with all the links in the sites for all the properties and all the restaurants and how you just maintain all the cross-linking, but just the larger maps for the countries. We had to generate all of those. Most people, you know, some maps just have too much detail on them. They're not really relevant, so they just wanted to see where we went. There's just a lot of...
That's $300,000. What else did you invest in?
A lot of it was just in terms of the writing, the trips, The marketing, we've started now, it's more about just branding. This year is more about branding and just driving traffic. So obviously we've got a fairly active Twitter funnel, and there's somebody that manages that part-time. Mostly just sort of the marketing, the PR, the development, and the writing. And it's been going on for 3 years, but it's a totally internet-based company. There's no office. No one's sitting around. We got one full-time travel agent that is there in case somebody wants very high-end services. She was my Centurion agent for 15 years, so she understands my trips without anybody having to explain them to her. So she understands service.
So she can book trips for people on the site.
She doesn't book them. We basically qualify it to the right partner
I
because
see.
it doesn't meet our needs to sit on this,
But
converting it.
she would actually take a phone call from someone on the site and help out.
If somebody wants to do that, they can.
I see. And
So
she's a full-timer at the company.
yep.
Okay. And trips are included in here too, so when you're traveling around, it's considered research and you get to include that in the cost of doing business.
Yes.
I see. Okay. How many members do you have so far?
We haven't shared that, but it only went live April 7th. And so we don't have a lot of data in terms of the month to month, but I think we're averaging about 100 a month. I mean, we got Google Analytics, so that's basically the data we had since April 7th.
100 registered members or 100 uniques
New uniques since April 7th per
to the
month.
site. Okay. All right. By the way, great write-off, right? If you end up in a business that's around travel and you get to take as many trips as you want and write them off.
I hope so.
Okay. All right, let's go back to 1996. That was a previous company, CrossWorld Software. You say that a lot of students ask you, what was that aha moment? What was the big idea? When I ask the same question, what was that?
Well, I think partly if I hadn't been at Oracle and Sybase and gone through the database wars, I would not have had the perspective of seeing, you have to anticipate where innovation and technology is going. Unless you can have the right product at the wrong time, or have, maybe the most awesome team and have, a really terrible product, but at the right time. There's a lot of variables you don't control. And I mean, partly some people just, there's a natural momentum to things. So I think you've just got to trust your own gut and make those big forks in the road, because you've got some key decisions you have to make sometimes, and your life can be so different depending on which decision track you take. I've seen people time and again have a couple great opportunities, pick one, and their life was so changed. And they always, you don't want to regret, what would I have done, or how would I be different if I took the other path? So it was to the point when I finished at Oracle and Sybase, I ended up with, it was a $150 million business. I was running three different development groups, the Distributed Objects and Connectivity Group. I'd worked a lot with the Wall Street business, designing just really technical products, rep server for global trading apps. I really loved really mission-critical enterprise-based apps where it challenged us technically. I think I just thrive on innovation. So going to CrossWorlds was mostly seeing an opportunity for integration for enterprise apps, because everything else had evolved up the stack and commoditized. But if I hadn't worked in database, I would never have seen that opportunity. So as database then commoditized, it didn't much matter which database you used, basically, DB2, Oracle. As you moved up the stack, it was like then there was enterprise apps like SAP and Siebel. And there's hundreds more of those enterprise apps, iTunes, Manugistics, JD Edwards, whatever vertical industry you go into, there is a specific enterprise app. And you're not a very compelling solution if you only say, oh, by the way, I only integrate a couple of them. You have to integrate all of them. It meant raising a lot of money, and it also meant getting source code from all of the partners. So I didn't choose to raise venture. I raised 80 million by going to my partners. Most of them were really flush with cash at the time, had done secondaries of their own IPOs. So it was perfect timing for them to want to also be part of this. And so think of us as we were the Switzerland of integration, because they were all competitors. They weren't about to help share and help each other. So we commoditized integration only because Java made it possible for us to encapsulate the business logic. If we didn't have an object language, we'd never have done
Let
it.
me dumb it down for people who are more like me, who are more like me, but maybe didn't spend as much research as I did today. In the dumbed down version, enterprise, big companies have lots of different programs from lots of different providers. Each one of these programs sits in its own little world. What you did was you helped them all talk to each other, right?
Right.
kind of like the way that for a long time my Google contacts didn't work with my iPhone contacts, and everything else was all in its own little world. Companies have those kind of issues in a bigger way, and you had a solution that you could bring to them that would save them money over creating their own. Am I getting it right?
Yeah, I mean, it was the value and cost of ownership proposition that a very large company that would have standardized on something like an SAP for inventory management, or like a Siebel for CRM, or office automation, Salesforce management, contact management. How do you basically integrate? Everything was being done by Anderson Consultants, to give an example. They were writing custom code. Those guys cost a lot of money.
Yep.
So most of the customers were really happy to hear there was an alternative to finally have those people leave. Because what they were writing was point-to-point integrations that was custom. And so when people upgraded their systems to the newer version of SAP or whatever, the integrations that the Anderson guys would break. Point-to-point it's not version transparent. So what we mentioned earlier about being object-oriented, that's version transparent. So people just didn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. The integration kept working when they upgraded their systems.
Okay. In addition to the money that you raised from companies like Intel, I'm reading off my list here, Ernst & Young, Michael Dell himself, Soros Technology Partners, and so on, you and your husband made a big point that you were investing your own money, $5.5 million of your own money, which is a bold thing for an entrepreneur to do. Where did that money come from?
Mostly from working at Oracle and Sybase. That was, again, managing my career to make sure I had equity. So again, if you don't manage your career from the start, you're not going to ever have the equity to do anything you want. And the part of the reason for this was we led every round, set the price and the terms. And so our partners felt we had skin in the game as well to share the risk. I wasn't sort of plowing in early at a cheap price. It gave them comfort that we were all in there at the same price on each round. And if they lost, I lost. If I won, they won. So it was sharing the risk. And it was just basically, I think, a better, that's a lot of what I talk about at Stanford. It's like, why did you choose to raise non-venture? And I had two of my sons while I was running CrossWorld. So the other question I always get, well, how do you raise money when you're pregnant? I said, well, unless you make it an issue, I don't think it's an issue. Just women ask very strange questions sometimes.
Nobody asked a question about pregnancy at the time? It wasn't an issue. Wow.
I think because we're executing, and part of it is, the other question I get is, you know, how do you do all this? And I said, well, this Rolodex of people I'd worked with, all these partners, I'd already worked with them for 10 years at Sybase and Oracle. These weren't people I didn't know. So they didn't care that I was pregnant. I mean, most of them were having kids too. And I mean, I got asked once in a press interview, which was entirely inappropriate, but somebody asked me, when was I planning to have my next child? I said, do you ask a male CEO those questions? So it was kind of like, I think you crossed a line. Again, that's the gender issue. It should be completely irrelevant. As long as you make your investors money, it shouldn't matter what you are.
So did you make your investors money? I ask that because it looks like the company raised $80 million. It was sold to IBM, according to their press release at the time, for $129 million. Did you make your investors money?
Of course we did, yes. Yeah.
But when it went public at 10. When it sold for $3.54 a share.
Mm-hmm.
This company...
You got to remember that a lot of what the competitors didn't get out. We were the second last company to go public when the market shut down the first time. So that IPO window shut down completely. So the ones that didn't get out at all. Their stock dropped to nothing. And I think if the alternative was to not go public, you know, that's why the IBM thing was already there. I wrote two patents for the company. So that was I'd already been talking to IBM for a couple of years. Because the alternative as a CEO, you have to be considering, if you can't go public, what is the alternative? Which is probably M&A to sell. So, I mean, just keeping a company and burning cash alive, you know, and seeing the market shut down. I think the only thing I would have changed is our board was a little conservative. So I think, you know, sometimes that's one thing I learned in terms of board composition. It's hard to fire board members, so make sure you hire the right board members. Make sure that whole DNA of that we're all very in sync. We were very sensitive. We had so much money in the deal personally that we went bent over backwards to make sure that everybody sort of did what we thought was the right thing for the company. Otherwise, you're going to get a shareholder lawsuit. I mean, the market's fairly efficient. So the fact that it did go public versus the alternative, the other competitors didn't get out at all. And then, you know, 6 months later, IBM buying it, sort of validates. I think it's just the market was so down at the time. At least we got out. That made the employees and the investors and the partners all very happy. And then the closure with the IBM was sort of the cherry on the top for everybody.
I see. What was your net gain on the money you invested?
I mean, I think in most cases, if you can, at a minimum, double your money, yeah, I mean, 2-3x in this market or that market back then, you can't be too greedy. I think sometimes you have to just sort of see if it was going to be any less than that, then you would have changed course. So otherwise, we would have been losing our own money as well.
So you're saying that you were able to double the 5.5 million that I read so much about, you guys were able to double the 5.5 that you personally invested?
Yeah, I try to always do 2-3x minimum on any of my investments, whether it's Crossworlds. I've got a lot of money in Tapulous, which is an iPhone app company we have. I'm the largest investor there, and it's up to like 25 million unique users in 15 months. Part of it is you got to have metrics of measurement. It can't be subjective about just money. You've got to have other measurements. But in the end, it is about the results of making money for your investors, whether you're private or public.
Okay. Tapulous, you mentioned that you're an investor in them. How did they're the ones who create the TapTap Revenge game that's incredibly popular. I think they've got, I don't know how many people they have. Is it 25 million people who are playing their games? It is.
Yep.
So how did you hook up with the founders there?
Again, it goes back to the Rolodex is, you know, I've only ever lived and worked in Silicon Valley. I think that's partly why I'm encouraging people to make sure they sort of focus on the networking for their own careers. Because you never know who you're going to probably do a deal with down the road. And so I can probably do about 3 companies a year as a private personal equity investor. If I don't have at least 10%, it's not really worth my time to sit on the board because I'm a very hands-on operational type of person. And usually it's very much, that's the funnest phase of a startup is when you're starting it from a blank sheet of paper. So again, these were people I'd known. We were all pretty much on the same page in terms of I've been a CEO before, so I knew I was not going to micromanage these guys. Been there, done it. It's like all founders care about is dilution and control. I'm like, you don't have to preach that to me. Been there, done it. And so I can take their perspective. Sometimes I'm a more ideal investor because I'm already on the same page.
How specifically did you connect with them? How did you know them?
Through other venture guys that I do private deals with.
I see a lot
of due diligence on the same deals that go around. So I'd say these are sort of beyond the angel guys doing, you know, little bits here and there. We're pretty serious about this kind of stuff.
I see. So am I hearing it right that other angel investors who are looking at the company said, let's bring her in. Let's show her the business.
It was pretty much we were there when it first started.
I see. That's why I'm especially interested. Who introduced you? Can you say that?
No, I mean, it's basically there's a couple other guys that I've worked with that are now venture guys, but they, when I had Crossworlds and when I was at Sybase, they were at Sun and then Neon. Again, if you go back in time, they're all people I've known that before we even started investment, we were all in operating roles. So it's all the same people I knew back then. So we're basically investing and trusting each other. So we always bring each other deals all the time. That's just how we work.
I see. Okay.
And we came together on this. And we decided to only fund the company. It's very frugal. We didn't need to raise venture.
For Tapulous, you didn't.
Right.
Okay.
They just, well, these companies don't need that much money. It's just not the same as enterprise software.
How do you think they caught on? What is it about them that made them work? And then we'll come back to Crossworlds in a bit.
I think mostly the organic, youthful way to adopt the social sort of growth that's out there. I think and if somebody is older, they're not going to figure out how to adapt to the social upselling that goes on. And I think part of it is just moving so fast. It's like try something. It's almost like how fast we have to keep the freshness with My Little Swans. And that's why the site had to be really sort of scalable. If you're trying to push a game or anything that's socially organic, it can get stale really fast. So it's the same for set as for games, music. Your community is going to just walk away if there's not something of value there that's interesting and changing all the time. So new titles, obviously more social engagement. Those are key metrics for us, session times, integration with Facebook for sharing scores. How do you integrate various games so kids can play? I mean, it's mostly they tell us what they want in the social engagement. They'll tell us what things that we need to do, and it's partly then you go, they feel like they have that intimate relationship with you. I think the larger game companies don't have that intimacy. That's partly why they, some of them haven't executed in this area.
Okay, back to Crossworld. I did a search for your name, as I always Google people before they come here for the interview, and that ad came on. You know the ad I'm talking about?
Oh, yes.
How would you describe that ad to someone who hadn't seen it? And then what's your feeling on it all these years later?
Well, I think that's a great example of the people that had the most negative reaction to it were the people that were sitting in Silicon Valley, because it changed the competitive landscape, which
was what
my...
Can you describe to people what it was? What was the ad?
I was in a black dress, but clearly most people thought it was... I mean, I don't know how we're so different to LA, but clearly it was not appropriate for my stereotype of what people must think a nerdy software CEO is supposed to do and wear. So I'm sitting there going, so what was I supposed to dress like? So it challenged stereotype. I'm in a black dress. We hired Richard Avedon to take the shoot. And I mean, the fact of the matter is we knew what we'd spend on it, but it generated 10x in reprint and controversy of, you know, the amount more ink that we got written about the company. So it was a branding ploy where, I mean, God, for me to explain Crossworlds in 5 seconds, it's kind of, I love to dive into the technology. Partly that's too hard to sell really quickly. So we placed the ad looking like editorial so we could brand the company with a face and a personality behind the company. And literally the further I went east and all the way to Europe, it was very well received. It was hanging in people's cubicles. It was kind of like we created a personality for the company. So the only people that had an issue with the competitors didn't know what to respond. And even advertising age said it was very successful because it created that controversy. And there's some kind of an emotional reaction that generated more people to write about it. So the rewriting actually kept it bubbling in the sort of online world. So, you know, you can't regret anything. But it was basically a branding strategy. I just think in software and tech, people hadn't done that before, let alone a woman. But I challenged sort of saying, well, what was I supposed to look like? You know,
I remember seeing it for the first time before reading any articles about it. I think I saw it in Fortune magazine. It caught my eye. I didn't understand what the company was back then, but I also didn't think of it as scandalous. I read an article recently, in fact today, in preparation for this interview, that said it's like not just a picture out of Playboy, but like a centerfold. I went back and I re-looked at that picture to see, did I miss something? I really don't believe I did. It was one of the most tame, you can go pick up your kid from school picture ever.
I know. The most negative reaction were women in the Silicon Valley saying I'm not being a great role model for their daughters. And it was kind of like apparently I was revealing too much. And my answer was, well, what was I supposed to look like as a stereotype? And I think challenging stereotypes is healthy. But to your point, knowing, you know, I wasn't nude, for God's sakes. You know, it's kind of like Avedon wanted to do something very professional, especially for his name on it, but also just looking powerful. That was his main thing. It's sort of doing the boring black suit. I mean, we look at what's going on with women in politics. It's very predictable how you can get dressed to create a persona and then people just assume how you must be based on how you look. It was creating an image, and I wanted to challenge the stereotype. But you're right.
You said I wasn't nude. I would bet you just about any entrepreneur worth his title would be willing to be nude on a magazine cover if that's what it took. I would be willing to do it anywhere if that's what it took to build your business. And I can tell you that not only would they, but many have. You just need to do a Google search for Richard Branson to see him in that shot where he is nude coming out of the ocean. And not only are people not putting him down, they're cheering him on. And we should continue to cheer any entrepreneurs willing to do anything gutsy like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to draw your own line.
I got no line. Whatever it takes to build a business. Believe me, people are willing to sacrifice their families to build a business. They wouldn't. A guy who's willing to sacrifice his business wouldn't be willing to get in a black dress. Come on.
Well, I think you have to live with it. You have to not regret your decisions, no matter what you choose to do. I mean, we've got way more stuff that's online now you can't control. So I think the stakes are higher than what they were when I did this. But it's an interesting, I think there's a whole lot of interesting about commentary on online marketing and just how much the stakes are much more critical. You're right. I mean, it's micro fame. It's like quickly it's out there, and it could have been the dumbest thing in the world, but it's going to push so many eyeballs. So I agree with you.
Now, you say it's branding. What about this is the criticism from the time?
Mm-hmm.
Branding of yourself or branding of the business? There was a lot of criticism that it was branding of you as the entrepreneur, you as the person, cyber celebrity or business celebrity.
Well, no, that's an easy thing to answer. When you have a very technical sell, as was Crossworlds, to my point earlier, most people said, pretend you're talking to your mother when you're doing like the TV ads or something, so you can dumb it down or say, here's what it really does from a solution perspective. I dive into the technology quickly because I love it. But the bottom line is, it was putting a face on the company and humanizing it so that it didn't feel like some big enterprise software giant that no one could like figure out who was behind it. And I figured, well, there aren't that many women doing this. We've got a lot of money at stake. All the partners know me. We're sharing the risk. Why not just brand it? Otherwise, you're trying to figure out how to put yourself in an ad to generate business, and all it is going to be ugly, boring text about a product. So the alternatives for editorial, I mean, what would it have been? Besides success stories and putting out customers in, you know, obvious testimonial kind of marketing, what were the alternatives? So we wanted to generate a buzz and brand it with a personality.
The other thing I saw when I researched for this interview was your Facebook, which was open, with your Facebook photos. I felt a little embarrassed going through them. Is that intentional? Your mobile
which
me pictures?
Facebook?
Sorry?
Which, you mean my personal Facebook or the My Little Swans Facebook?
Your personal Facebook, including party pictures.
Oh, no, because those people, they were all the first members at My Little Swans. So I was very, very considerate of putting those on my personal versus on the My Little Swans. If they were on the My Little Swans, I think that it would cross the personal line of abusing my friendships.
I see. But having your pictures be public on Facebook, that's part of the process. The world is all public now.
Oh, I'm nowhere close to what my kids are doing on Facebook. I don't really do much. I'm not very obsessive on it, to be honest. I should be, but I'm not.
Going back to My Little Swans, 100 uniques on the website a month. Is this business really just your way of traveling and getting a write-off for all the travel?
Well,
you could tell me. You could tell me. We could be open with each other. We're now friends.
I guess we're building the value here to figure out how to value is it's a content site. So do we know how the market's going to value a content site? We don't actually know that yet because there's such a shakeout going on with how content's going to be actually searched and what the business model will be on like an iPad, for instance. The Atlantic article this month with Google on the cover is talking about a paying wall of how people will link into newspapers and magazines. So I think people are still shaking this out. So I actually think during time of recession that it's a great time to experiment or try new things because people think if you failed, then it was just the market conditions. It's a great time to sort of heads down. I mean, I'm busier than I've ever been because I just think, you know, a lot of people are just pretty miserable with not a whole lot to do right now. But I'm like, well, that's a great time if you haven't got any other commitments or distractions, go start something. And then if it doesn't work, you can always go back to work. So part of it was the demand of a lot of people really wanting this stuff. I'd ended up with 15 years of it. And I said, okay, let me just get it online. And the second part of it is, I'll give you this, Julia Child took 7 years to write her book. Good content doesn't happen overnight. And I think building loyalty and community, you know, most of the part of it is making sure the experience doesn't get compromised by just throwing any kind of crap on the site. We're just not going to do that. So it's just we've got a lot of content already that covers the world. And if we don't go somewhere, we tell people. It's just sort of like it'll get there. And if I had only this as my entire existence, then you're right. I'd probably maybe worry, but it's one of those. I'm a long-term investor. I don't get in and out of the market quick. You know, you look for trends, and that's when I was going back to the timing issues for anything, whether it's Tabulous, Crossworlds, or My Little Swans. Timing is everything. And I think, you know, Condé Nast is now on an iPad. Everybody is starting to try and get better luxury experiences on the iPad. So the worlds are colliding there. I think our timing is really good. And we've learned a lot in the last 2 years. And I think the interesting thing is the partners even get the model that we don't need middlemen anymore. So, but then users just need to learn to trust that kind of site behavior. So I'm not in a rush. It's adopting as quickly as it should. I mean, it's a pretty high-end demographic, so that we're never going to have millions and millions of users.
All right. If people want to see it, I guess they could go to mylittleswans.com. Is there a section of the site that you want to highlight that they should go check out to get a good sense of what it's about?
I think mostly that depending on where anybody usually thinks they really want to travel, click on that destination. You know, some of our favorite places that people always ask, what were the best and worst trips? You know, because I'm Australian, Africa, I'm just not very objective. We loved our African trips. I would go back there in a minute. They're some of the easiest trips too, because it's all casual. They give you a packing list. Your kids are offline. Nobody can really get on their BlackBerry. So everyone's kind of focused on just being out there with nature. I think, or Argentina.
We're in Africa. If I were going to take a trip in Africa, if I was going to say, Olivia, I'm going to whisk you away before we have kids. Maybe when we have kids, we take them on the plane too. But before, where do you say in Africa? What's a luxurious trip for us?
Probably Botswana, because you can do eco lodges or you can do luxury. It really has, it's the density that Botswana is a country that's never had civil wars. Because the animals come to you because they're waterlocked. So you don't have to go out in a Jeep for 8-10 hours. I mean, if you really don't want to work too hard at your trip. You can literally sort of pick and choose what you want to go see, because that delta, the Okavango Delta, there's just such a density of animals and lodges.
Okay, but my iPhone will not work.
Hopefully not.
All right, I'll find a way to live with that. Well, thank you. Thanks for doing the interview with me. Everyone, check out the website. Come back to Mixergy. Give me your feedback on it and on this interview. Thanks for doing the interview. It's good to meet you.
Thank you. Likewise. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.